around. We got this idea. One of the guys started walking him around. We all walked him around in circles like some kind of OD. Thought if we could keep him walking till the wagon came, he'd be okay. By the end, we was dragging him. I think Danny was dead. Blood all over everybody. The gun wasn't no more than an old 25. People was yelling at us to pile him in and take him to the hospital. But we'd got this walking him around idea in our heads, to hold him up and walk him in circles. The girl screaming and trying to put her stockings on. And we're yelling at the guy that shot him, how we were going to off with his map and so on and so forth. Till the keep called an ambulance, and they came, and he was dead as a stick.
Gately, that's really bad.
Why are you even up? Don't have to work.
I like it when it snows real early like this. This is the best window. But you learned a lesson.
His name was Chuck, or Chick, the one that got shot that time.
Did you hear that McDade person at supper? You know how some folks have one of their legs shorter than the other?
I don't listen to those guys' crap.
It was down at the far end of the table at supper. He was telling Ken and me how he had a counselor when he was in juvenile in Jamaica Plain. He had this counselor, he said, she had this condition where each leg was shorter than the other.
I don't think I follow you, Joel.
Each of the woman's legs was shorter than the other.
How can a leg that's shorter than the other leg have the other leg shorter than it?
He was having us on. He said the point was an AA point, that it defied sense and explaining, and you just had to accept it on faith. That creepy Randy guy with the white wig was backing him up with a very straight face. McDade said she walked like a metronome. He was making fun of us, but I still thought it was funny.
Maybe tell me about this veil of yours then, Joel, if we're talking about defied sense.
Way out to one side, then way out to the other side.
Really? Let's really interface if you're here then. How come with the veil?
Bridal thing. Aspiring Muslim?
I don't mean to pry in. You can just tell me if you don't want to talk about the veil.
I'm also in another fellowship with almost 4 years in.
UHID.
It's the union of the hideously and improbably deformed. The veil is a sort of fellowship comparison.
What's it compared to?
We all wear one. Almost all of us, with some time in.
But if you don't mind, how come you're in it? UHID? How are you supposed to be deformed? It's nothing that sticks way out, if I can say it. Are you, like, missing something?
There's a brief ceremony. It's a bit like giving out chips over at the Better Late Than Never meeting, for varying lengths. The new UHID stand and receive the veil, and don the veil, and stand there, and recite that the veil they've donned is a type and a symbol, and that they are choosing freely to be bound to wear it always, a day at a time, both in light and darkness, both in solitude and before others' gaze, and as with strangers, so with familiar friends, even daddies, that no mortal eye will see it withdrawn, that they hereby declare openly that they wish to hide from all sight, unquote. I've also got a membership card that spells out everything you could ever want to know, and more.
Except I've asked Pat and Tommy S., and still the thing I don't get is why join a fellowship just to hide? I can see if somebody's like, you know, hideously, and they've been hiding away in the dark all their life, and they want to come in and join a fellowship where everybody's equal and everybody can identify because they all spent their whole life hiding also. And you join a fellowship so you can step out of the dark and into the group and get support and finally show yourself minus eyes or with three arms or whatever and be accepted by people that know just what it's like. And like in AA, they say they'll love you till you can, like, love yourself and accept yourself. so you don't care what people see or think anymore. And you could finally step out of the cage and quit hiding.
That's AA?
Kinda. A little bit, I think.
Well, Mr. Gately, what people don't get about being hideously or improbably deformed is that the urge to hide is offset by a gigantic sense of shame about your urge to hide. You're at a graduate wine-tasting party, and improbably deformed, and you're the object of stares that the people try to conceal because they're ashamed of wanting to stare, and you want nothing more than to hide from the covert stares, to erase your difference, to crawl under the tablecloth or put your face under your arm. Or you pray for a power failure, and for this kind of utter, liberating, equalizing darkness to descend, so you can be reduced to nothing but a voice among other voices, invisible, equal, no different, hidden.
Is this like this thing they talked about people hating their faces on video phones?
But Don, you're still a human being. You still want to live. You crave connection in society. You know intellectually that you're no less worthy of connection and society than anyone else simply because of how you appear. You know that hiding yourself away out of fear of gazes is really giving in to a shame that is not required, and that will keep you from the kind of life you deserve as much as the next girl. You know that you can't help how you look, but that you are supposed to be able to help how much you care about how you look. You're supposed to be strong enough to exert some control over how much you want to hide, and you're so desperate to feel some kind of control that you settle for the appearance of control.
Your voice gets different when you talk about this shit.
What you do is you hide your deep need to hide, and you do this out of the need to appear to other people, as if you have the strength not to care how you appear to others. You stick your hideous face right in there, into the wine-tasting crowd's visual meat grinder. You smile so wide it hurts, and put out your hand, and are extra gregarious and outgoing, and exert yourself to appear totally unaware of the facial struggles of people who are trying not to wince, or stare, or give away the fact that they can see that you're hideously, improbably deformed. You feign acceptance of your deformity. You take your desire to hide and conceal it under a mask of acceptance.
Use less words.
In other words, you hide your hiding, and you do this out of shame, Don. You're ashamed of the fact that you want to hide from sight. You're ashamed of your uncontrolled craving for shadow. UHID's first step is admission of powerlessness over the need to hide. UHID allows members to be open about their essential need for concealment. In other words, we don the veil. We don the veil and wear the veil proudly and stand very straight and walk briskly whenever we wish, veiled and hidden, and but now completely upfront and unashamed about the fact that how we appear to others affects us deeply, about the fact that we want to be shielded from all sight. UHID supports us in our decision to hide openly.
You seem to like drift in and out of different ways of talking. Sometimes it's like you don't want me to follow.
Well, I've got a brand new life, just out of the wrapper, which you all say'll take some time to fit.
So they teach you how to accept your non-acceptance, the union, you're saying.
You followed very well. You didn't need fewer words at all. If you don't mind my saying so, my sense is, you think you're not bright, but you're not.
Not bright?
I put that poorly. You're not not bright, as in you're incorrect in thinking you have nothing upstairs.
It's a self-esteem issue, then, you're seeing in me, after like 3 days here, then. I feel low self-esteem about how I think I'm not bright enough for some people.
Which is fine, UHID would say, to illustrate the UHID take versus an apparently more AA take. UHID'd say it's fine to feel inadequate and ashamed because you're not as bright as some others. But that the cycle becomes annular and insidious if you begin to be ashamed of the fact that being unbright shames you, if you try to hide the fact that you feel mentally inadequate, and so go around making jokes about your own dullness, and acting as if it didn't bother you at all, pretending you didn't care whether others perceived you as unbright or not.
This makes the front of my head hurt, trying to follow this.
Well, you've been up all night.
Then now I have to go to my other fucking job.
You're way brighter than you think, Don G. Although I doubt anything anyone else says can get in there, into the gnawed, ragged place where you're afraid you're slow and dull.
And what makes you think I think I'm not bright, unless it's you're saying it's obvious to anybody I'm not bright?
I didn't mean to pry. Just tell me if you don't want to speak to someone you barely know about it.
Now you're being sarcastic in what I said before. I got kicked off of football my 10th grade year for flunking English.
You played American football?
I was good till I got kicked off. They gave me a tutor, and I still flunked.
I used to twirl a baton at halftimes. I went to a special camp, 6 summers running. But a lot of the forms of self-hatred there is no veil for. UHID's taught a lot of us to be grateful that there's at least a veil for our form.
So the veil's a way to not hide it.
To hide openly is more like it. I'm already seeing it's very different from the drug recovery agenda, the AA and NA program.
Can I ask how you're deformed?
The best is when the sun's coming up right through the snow. And everything looks so white. I almost forgot why I came on in. That Kate girl said Ken E. liked to get killed by some son of a bitch last night at that Waltham N.A. thing. And they want somebody to tell Jeanette not to make them go back again, if they don't want.
One is Kate and Ken can talk for themselves with Jeanette. And I don't need to pry in. And you sure don't need to pry in and rescue nobody else. Two is you're all of a sudden talking different again. And when you're talking about the veil, you didn't sound like you to me. And three is, don't think I can't see you coming out sideways all over the place about when I asked, can I ask what deformity you're not hiding? The fact that you're hiding under that thing. The staff part of me wants to say, if you don't want to answer it, just say so. But don't try and go around the side and think you can distract me into forgetting I asked it.
The UHID in me would say you're trapped in the shame about the shame in response, and that the shame circle keeps you from really being present for your staff job, Don. You're more bugged by the possibility that I'm treating you as unbright and distractible than you are about a resident's inability to come right out and openly exercise her right to refuse to answer an incredibly private and drug-unrelated question.
And now she's back to talking like a fucking English teacher again. But ignore that. That's not the point. Look at how you're trying to get our dialogue all distracted up in shame and me again instead of saying yes or no to me asking, will you tell me what you're missing behind that veil?
Oh, you're good at hiding, Mr. G. You're good. The minute we start to poke at any inadequacies you're ashamed of, see? You drop behind your own protective mask of house staff and start probing areas that you now know I can't bring myself to be open about, since you got me to tell you all about UHID's philosophy of hiding, so that your own sense of inadequacy gets either buried or used as a backlight to illuminate my own inability to be open and straightforward. The best defense is a good offense, isn't it, Mr. Football Player?
Aspirin time now with all the words. You win. Go watch the snow come down someplace else.
The thing is, Mr. Staff, I've already just completely opened up about my shame and my inability to be open and straightforward about this. You're exposing something I've already held up to view. It's your shame about being ashamed of what you're afraid might be seen as a lack of brightness. That's getting to stay buried under this dead horse of my deformity that you're trying to whip.
And then meantime, you still don't say a straight-on yes or no. To, can I ask what's up behind there? Are you cross-eyed or have like a beard? Or do you have like really bad skin under there? Even though your skin every place that isn't hidden looks...
Looks what? My unhidden skin is what?
See? This is you keep trying to sidetrack instead of just saying no to can I ask. Just say no. Try it. It's okay. Nothing bad will happen. Just try it straight out.
Perfect. You were going to say every visible expanse of my skin is just drop-dead creamy. Perfect.
Jesus, why am I even here? Why don't you just interface with yourself if you think you know all my issues and shames and everything I'm going to say? Why not take the suggestion to say no? Why come in here? Did I come to you to talk? Was I just sitting in here trying to keep awake and do the log and getting ready to go mop shit with a shoe freak? And did or did not you waltz on in and sit down and come to me?
Don, I'm perfect. I'm so beautiful I drive anybody with a nervous system out of their fucking mind. Once they've seen me, they can't think of anything else and don't want to look at anything else and stop carrying out normal responsibilities and believe that if they can only have me right there with them at all times, everything will be all right. Everything. Like I'm the solution to their deep, slavering need to be jowled to cheek with perfection.
Now with the sarcasm.
I am so beautiful. I am deformed.
Now with the non-respectful acting out of treating me like I'm stupid for trying to get her to walk through her fear to give a straight-out no, which she isn't willing.
I am deformed with beauty.
You want to see my professional staff face? Here's my staff face. I nod and smile. I treat you like somebody I have to humor by nodding and smiling. And behind the face, I'm going with my finger around and around my temple like, what a fucking yutz, like, where's the net?
Believe what you want. I'm powerless over what you believe, I know.
See the professional staffer writing in the meds log? 6 extra strong kind aspirin for staff after sarcasm and sideways refusal to walk through fears and sarcastic acting out by newcomer who thinks she knows everybody else's issues.
What position did you play?
That the staffer wonders how come she's even here in treatment then, if she knows so much. It is starting to get quietly around Ennett House that Randy Lentz has found his own dark way to deal with the well-known rage and powerlessness issues that beset the drug addict in his first few months of abstinence. The nightly AA or NA meetings get out at 2130 hours or 2200 hours, and curfew isn't until 2330, and every Ennett resident mostly carpools back to the house with whatever residents have cars, or some of them go out in cars for massive doses of ice cream and coffee. Lance is one of the ones with the car, a heavily modified old Duster, white with what looked like 12-gauge blasts of rust over the wheel wells, with oversized rear tires and an engine so bored out for heavy breathing speed, it's a small miracle he still has a license. Lentz sets Loafer 1 outside Ennett House only after sunset, and then only in his white toupee and mustache and billowing tall-collared topcoat, and goes only to the required nightly meetings. And the thing is that he'll never drive his own car to the meetings. He always thumbs along with somebody else and adds to the crowd in their car. And then he always has to sit in the northernmost seat in the car for some reason, using a compass and napkin to plot out what the night's major direction of travel will be, and then figuring out what seat he'll have to be in to stay maximally north. Both Gately and Jeanette Fultz have had to make a nightly routine of telling the other residents that Lentz is teaching them valuable patience and tolerance. But then after the meeting lets out, Lentz never thumbs back with anybody. He always walks back to the house after meetings. He says it's that he needs the air. What with being shut up in the crowded house all day and avoiding doors and windows, hiding from both sides of the justice system.
And then one Wednesday, after the Brookline Young People's AA up Beacon by Chestnut Hill, it takes him right up to 23:29 to get home, almost 2 hours, even though it's like a half-hour walk. And even Bert Smith did it in September in under an hour.
And Lentz gets back just at curfew, and without saying a word to anybody, books it right up to his and Glenn's and Day's room. Polo topcoat flapping, and powdered wig shedding powder, and sweating, and making an unacceptable, classy-shoed racket, running up the men's side's carpetless stairs, which Gately didn't have time to go up and address, because of having to deal with Bruce Green and Amy J., separately both missing curfew. Lentz abroad in the urban night, solo, on almost a nightly basis, sometimes carrying a book. Residents who seem to make it a point to go off alone a lot are red flagged at Thursday's all-staff meeting in Pat's office as clear relapse risks. But they've pulled spot urines on Lentz 5 times, and the 3 times the lab didn't fuck up the EMIT test, Lentz's urines come back clean. Gately's basically decided to just let Lentz be. Some newcomers' higher power is like nature, the sky, the stars, the cold penny tang of the autumn air. Who knows? So Lentz abroad in the night, unaccompanied and disguised, apparently strolling. He's mastered the streets, cockeyed grid around Enfield, Brighton, Alston, South Cambridge and East Newton and North Brookline and the hideous spur. He takes side streets home from meetings, mostly. Low-rent dumpster-strewn residential streets and projects driveways that become alleys. Gritty passages behind stores and dumpsters and warehouses and loading docks and Empire Waste displacements, Mongo hangars, etc. His loafers have a wicked shine and make an elegant, dancerly click as he walks along with his hands in his pockets, an open coat flared wide, scanning. He scans for several nights before he even becomes aware of why or what he might be scanning for.
224.
He moves nightly through urban animal territory. Liberated house cats and hardcore strays ooze in and out of shadows, rustle in dumpsters, fuck and fight with hellish noises all around him as he walks, senses very sharp in the downscale night. You got your rats, your mice, your stray dogs with tongues hanging and countable ribs. Maybe the odd feral hamster and or raccoon. Everything slinky and furtive after sunset. Also, non-stray dogs that clank their chains or bay or lunge when he goes by yards with dogs. He prefers to move north, but will move east or west on the street's good sides. His shoes' fine click precedes him by several 100 meters on cement of varying texture. Sometimes near drainage pipes he sees serious rats, or sometimes near cat-free dumpsters. The first conscious thing he did was a rat. That this one time he came on some rats in a wide west-east alley by the loading dock out behind the Svelte Nail Company, just east of Watertown on North Harvard Street. What night was that? It'd been coming back from East Watertown, which meant more will be revealed, N.A., with Glenn and Deal, instead of St. E.'s Better Late Than Never, A.A., with the rest of the houses heard. So, a Monday. So, on a Monday, he'd been strolling through this one alley, his steps echoing, trebled back off the cement signs of the docks and the north left wall he hugged, scanning without knowing what he was scanning for. Up ahead there was the stegosaurus shape of a Svelte Company dumpster, as versus your lower, slimmer EWD-type dumpster. There were dry, skulky sounds issuing from the dumpster's shadow. He hadn't consciously picked anything up. The alley's surface was coming apart, and Lentz barely broke his dancerly stride picking a kilo-sized chunk of tar-shot concrete. It was rats. Two big rats were going at a half-eaten wiener in a mustardy paper tray from a lunch wagon in a recess between the north wall and the dumpster's barge hitch. Their hideous pink tails were poking out into the alley's dim light. They didn't move as Randy Lentz came up behind them on the toes of his loafers. Their tails were meaty and bald and like twitched back and forth, twitching in and out of the dim yellow light. The big flat-top chunk came down on most of one rat and a bit of the other rat. There'd been god-awful twittering squeaks, but the major hit on the one rat also made a very solid and significant noise, some aural combination of a tomato thrown at a wall and a pocket watch getting clocked with a hammer. Material came out of the rat's anus. The rat lay on its side in a very bad medical way, its tail twitching, and anus material, and there were little beads of blood on its whiskers that looked black, the beads, in the sodium security lights along the Svelte Nail Company roof. Its side heaved. Its back legs were moving like it was running, but this rat wasn't going anywhere. The other rat had vanished under the dumpster, dragging its rear region. There were more chunks of dismantled street, lying all over. When Lance brought another down on the head of the rat, he consciously discovered what he liked to say at the moment of issue resolution was, "There." Demapping rats became Lance's way of resolving internal type issues for the first couple weeks of it, walking home in the verminal dark. Don Gately, house chef and shopper, buys these huge, econo-sized boxes of hefty bags,
225,
that get stored under the kitchen sink for whoever's got trash for their weekly chore. And in-house generates serious waste. So after vermin started to get a little ho-hum and insignificant, Lentz starts cabbaging a hefty bag out from under the sink and taking it with him to meetings and walking back home with it. He keeps a trash bag neatly folded in an inside pocket of his topcoat, a billowing top-collared Lauren Polo model he loves and uses a daily lint roller on. He also takes along a little of the house's food bank tuna fish in a Ziploc baggie in another pocket, which your average drug addict has expertise in rolling baggies into a cylinder so they're secure and odor-free. The in-house residents called hefty bags Irish luggage, even McDade. It's a street term. Randy Lentz found that if he could get an urban cat up close enough with some outstretched tuna, he could pop the hefty bag over it and scoop up from the bottom. So the cat was in the air in the bottom of the bag, and then he could tie the bag shut with the complimentary wire twist tie that comes with each bag. He could put the closed bag down next to the vicinity's northernmost wall or fence or dumpster and light a gasper and hunker down up next to the wall to watch the wide variety of changing shapes the bag would assume as the agitated cat got lower on air. The shapes got more and more violent and twisted and mid-air with the passage of a minute. After it stopped assuming shapes, Lentz would dab his butt with a spitty finger to save the rest for later and get up and untie the twist tie and look inside the bag and go, "There." The "there" turned out to be crucial for the sense of brisance and closure, and resolving issues of impotent rage and powerless fear that, like, accrued in Lentz all day being trapped in the northeastern portions of a squalid halfway house, all day fearing for his life, Lentz felt. There evolved for Lentz a certain sportsman's hierarchy of types of cats and neighborhoods of types of your abroad cats. And he becomes a connoisseur of cats the same way a deep-sea sportsman knows the fish species that fight most fiercely and excitingly for their marine lives. The best and most fiercely alive cats could usually claw their way out of a hefty bag, though, which created this conundrum where the ones most worth watching, assuming bag shapes, were the ones Lentz risked maybe not getting his issues resolved on. Watching a spike-furred, hissing cat run twisting away still half-wrapped in a plastic bag made Lentz admire the cat's fighting spirit, but still feel unresolved, So the next stage is, Lance gives Ms. Charlotte Treat or Ms. Hester Thrall some of his own dollars when they go down to the Palace Spa or Father-Son to buy smokes or lifesavers, and has them start to get him special hefty steel sack trash bags.
226.
Fiber reinforced for your especially sharp or uncooperative waist needs, described by Ken E. as Irish Gucci's. Extra resilient, and a businesslike gunmetal gray in tone. Lance has such a panoply of strange compulsive habits that a request for steel sacks barely raises a brow on anybody. And then he doubles them, the special reinforced bags, and employs industrial growth pipe cleaners as twist ties. And then now the grittiest, most salutary cats make the doubled bags assume all manners of wickedly abstract twisting shapes, even sometimes moving the closed bags a couple dozen meters down the alley in a haphazard hopping-like fashion, until finally the cat runs out of gas and resolves itself and Lance's issues into one nightly shape. Lance's interval of choice for this is the interval 22:16 hours to 22:26 hours. He doesn't consciously know why, this interval. Anchovies turn out to be even more effective than tuna. A program of attraction, he recalls coolly, strolling along. His northern routes back to the house are restricted by the priority to keep Brighton Best Savings Bank's rooftop digital time and temperature display in view as much as possible. BBSB displays both EST and Greenwich Mean, which Lance approves of. The liquid crystal data sort of melts upward into view on the screen and then disappears from the bottom up and is replaced by new data. Mr. Dooney R. Glynn said at the House's community meeting Monday once that one time in B.S. 1989 A.D., after he'd done a reckless amount of a hallucinogen he'd refer to only as the Madam, he'd gone around for several subsequent weeks under a Boston sky that, instead of a kindly curved blue dome with your clouds and your stars and sun, was a flat, square, coldly Euclidean grid with black axes and a thread-fine réseau of lines creating grid-type coordinates, the whole grid the same color as a DEC HD viewer screen when the viewer's off, that sort of dead, deep-water gray-green, with the Dow ticker running up one side of the grid and the Nikkei index running down the other, and the time and Celsius temp, to like serious decimal points, flashing along the bottom axis of the sky screen. And whenever he'd go to a real clock, or get a herald and check the, like, Dow, the sky grid would turn out to have been totally accurate, and that several unbroken weeks of this sky overhead had sent Glynn off first to his mother's Stoneham apartment's fold-out couch, and then into Waltham's Metropolitan State Hospital for a month of Haldol and tapioca.
227.
To get out from under the empty grid accurate sky, and says it makes his ass wet to this day to even think about the grid interval. But Lance had thought it sounded wicked nice, the sky as digital timepiece. And also between 22:16 and 22:26, the ATH SCME giant fans off up at the Sunstrand Plaza with an earshot were typically shut off for daily delinting, and it was quiet except for the big shh of the whole urban city's vehicular traffic, and maybe the odd EWD airborne deliverer catapulted up off concavityward, its little string of lights arcing northeast. And, of course, also sirens, both the Euro-trochaic sirens of ambulances and the regular U.S.-sounding sirens of the city's very finest, protecting and serving, keeping the citizenry at bay. And the winsome thing about sirens in the urban night is that unless they're right up close where the lights bathe you in red, blue, red, they always sound like they're terribly, achingly far away and receding, calling to you across an expanding gap. Either that, or they're on your ass. No middle distance with sirens, Lance reflects,
walking along and scanning.
Glenn hadn't come right out and said Euclidean, but Lance had gotten the picture all right. Glenn had thin hair and an invariant 3-day growth of gray stubble and diverticulitis that made him stoop somewhat over, and remaining physique-type issues from a load of bricks falling on his head from a workers' comp scam gone wry that included crossed eyes that Lance overheard the veiled girl, Joe L., tell Clannette Henderson and Dee Dee Neves the man was so cross-eyed he could stand in the middle of the week and see both Sundays. Lance had gotten high on organic cocaine 2 or 3, maybe 6 times tops, secretly, since he came into Ennett House in the summer, just enough times to keep him from going totally out of his fucking mind, utilizing lines from the private emergency stash he kept in a kind of rectangular bunker, razor-bladed out of 300 or so pages of Bill James's gargantuan, large print, Principles of Psychology and the Gifford Lecture on Natural Religion. Such totally occasional substance ingestions in a rundown, sloppy-clocked house, where he's cooped up and under terrible stress all day, every day, hiding from threats from 2 different legal directions, with, upstairs at all times, calling to him, a 20-gram stash from the underreported South End 2-way attempted scam, whose very bad luck had forced him into hiding in squalor and rooming with the likes of fucking Jeffrey D. Cocaine ingestion this occasional and last resort is such a marked reduction of use and abuse for Lance that it's a bona fide miracle and clearly constitutes as much miraculous sobriety as total abstinence would be for another person without Lance's unique sensitivities and psychological makeup and fucking intolerable daily stresses and difficulty unwinding. And he accepts his monthly chips with a clear conscience and a head unmuddled by doubting. He knows he's sober. He's smart about it. He's never ingested cocaine on his solo walks home from meetings, which is where the staff would expect him to ingest, if he was going to ingest, and never in Ennett House itself, and only once in the forbidden number 7 across the roadlet. And anybody with half a clue can beat any mitt urine screen. A cup of lemon juice or vinegar down the hatch will turn the lab's reading into gibberish. A trace of powdered bleach on the fingertips, and let the stream play warmly over the fingertips on its way into the cup, while you banter with Don G. A Texas catheter is a pain to get piss for and put on, plus the obscene size of the thing's receptacle for his unit gives Lance inadequacy issues, and he's only used it twice, both times when Jeanette F. took the urine, and he could embarrass her into turning away. Lance owns a Texas Cathy from his last halfway house in Quincy, in what Lance recalls as the year of the Maytag Quiet Master. And then, it turned out, when a cat aggrieved Lance by scratching his wrist in a particularly hostile fashion on the way into the receptacle, that doubled hefty steel sacks were such quality-reinforced products they could hold something razor-clawed and frantically in motion and still survive a direct swung hit against a no-parking sign or a telephone pole without splitting open, even when what was inside split nicely open. And so that technique got substituted around United Nations Day because, even though it was too quick and less meditative, it allowed Randy Lentz to take a more active role in the process, and the feeling of temporary, nightly, issues resolution was more definitive when Lance could swing a twisting 10-kilo burden hard against a pole and go, there, and hear a sound. On banner nights, the doubled bag would continue for a brief period of time to undergo a subtle flux of smaller, more subtle, and connoisseur-oriented shapes, even after the melony sound of hard impact, along with further, smaller sounds. Then it was discovered that resolving them directly inside the yards and porches of the people that owned them provided more adrenal excitation and thus more sense of what Bill James one time called a catharsis of resolving, which Lance felt he could agree. A small can of oil in its own little baggie for squeaky gates. But because steel sack trash bags, and then also tuna fish mixed with anchovies and Raid ant poison from behind the Ennett residence fridge, caused too much resultant noise to to allow for lighting a gasper and hunkering down to meditatively watch. Lentz developed the habit of setting the resolution in motion and then booking on out of the yard into the urban night, his polo topcoat billowing, hurtling fences and running over the hoods of cars, etc. For a period during the two-week interval of give them poison tuna and run, Lentz had brief recourse to a small Caldor brand squeeze bottle of kerosene, plus, of course, his lighter. But a Wednesday night, on which the alight cat ran, as alight cats will, like hell, but ran after Lentz, seemingly, leaping the same fence as Lentz hurtled, and staying on his tail, and not only making an unacceptable attention-calling racket, but also illuminating Lentz to the scopophobic view of passing homes, until it finally decided to drop to the ground and expire and smolder thereupon. Lentz considered this his only really close call, and took an enormous, and partly non-north, route home, with every siren sounding up close, and on his personal ass, and barely got in by 23:30 hours, and ran right up to the three-man room. This was the night Lentz had to have another recourse to the hollowed-out cavity in his Principles of Psychology and the Gifford Lecture on Natural Religion, after just beating curfew home, which, who wouldn't need a bit of an unwinder after a stressful, close-call-type situation with a flaming cat chasing you and screaming in a way that made porch lights go on all up and down Sumner Blake Road, except, but instead of an unwinder, the couple or few lines of uncut Bing proved to be, on this occasion, an un-unwinder. Which happens sometimes, depending on one's, like, spiritual condition when ingesting it through a rolled dollar bill off the back of the John in the men's can. And Lentz barely made it through switching his car's parking spot at 23:50 hours before the verbal torrent started, and after lights out, had only gotten up to age 8 in the oral autobiography that followed in The Three Men, when Jeff D. threatened to go get Don G. and have Lentz forcibly stifled, and Lentz was scared to go downstairs to find somebody to listen, and so, for the rest of the night, he had to lie there in the dark, mute, with his mouth twisting and writhing. It always twisted and writhed on the times the Bing proved to be a rev upper instead of a rough edge smoother, and pretending to be asleep, with phosphenes like leaping flaming shapes dancing behind his quivering lids, listening to Day's moist gurgles and Glynn's apnea, and thinking that each siren abroad, out there in the urban city, was meant for him and coming closer. With Day's illuminated watch face in his fucking tableside drawer, instead of out where anybody with some stress and anxiety could check the time from time to time. So after the incident with the flaming cat from hell, and before Halloween, Lentz had moved on and up to the Browning X 444 serrated. He even had a shoulder holster for from his previous life out there. The Browning X 444 has a 25-centimeter overall length, with a burl walnut handle and a brass butt cap, and a point Lentz had sharpened the clip out of when he got it and a single-edge Bowie-style blade with 0.1-millimeter serrations that Lentz owns a hone for and tests by dry-shaving a little patch of his tanned forearm, which he loves. The Browning X 444, combined with blocks of Don Gately's highly portable cornflake garnish meatloaf, were for canines, which your urban canines tended to be non-feral and could be found within the confinement of their pet owners' fenced yards on a regular-er basis than the urban cat species, and who are less suspicious of food and, though more of a personal injury risk to approach, do not scratch the hand that feeds them. For when the dense square of meatloaf is taken out and unwrapped from the Ziploc and proffered from the edgelet of yard, out past the fence by the sidewalk, the dog at issue invariably stops with the barking and or lunging, and its nose flares, and it becomes totally uncynical and friendly, and comes to the end of its chain, or the fence Lentz stands behind, and makes interested noises, and, if Lentz holds the meat item just up out of reach, the dog, if its rope or chain will permit it, it'll go up on the hind legs and sort of play the fence with its front paws, jumping eagerly as Lentz dangles the meat. Day had had some recovery issue paperback he was reading that Lentz had a look at 1 p.m. in their room, when Day was downstairs with Ewell and her daddy, telling each other their win-bagathon stories, lying on Day's mattress with his shoes on, and trying to fart into the mattress as much as possible. Some line in the book had arrested Lentz's attention. Something about, the more basically powerless an individual feels, the more the likelihood for the propensity for violent acting out. And Lentz found the observation to be sound. The only serious challenge to using the Browning X-444 is that Lentz has to make sure to get around behind the dog before he cuts the dog's throat, because the bleeding is far-reaching in its intensity. And Lentz is now on his second Ralph Lauren topcoat and third pair of dark wool slacks. Then once, near Halloween, in an alley behind Blanchard's Liquors off Alston's Union Square, Lentz comes across a street drunk in a chewed-looking old topcoat in a deserted alley, taking a public leak against the side of a dumpster. And Lentz invisualizes the old guy both cut and on fire, and dancing, jaggedly, around, hitting at himself, while Lentz goes, "There." But that's as close as Lentz comes to that kind of level of resolution. And it's maybe to his credit that he's a little off his psychic feed for a few days after that close call, and inactive with pets, circa 22-16 hours. Lentz has nothing much against his newer fellow resident Bruce Green. And when, one Sunday night after the white flag, Green asks can he walk along with Lentz on the walk back, after the Our Father, Lentz says whatever, and lets Green walk with him, and is inactive during this night's 22-16 interval as well. Except after a couple nights of Green strolling home along with him, first from the white flag and then from St. Columbkill's on Tuesday, and a double 1900 to 2200 shot of St. E's sharing and caring N.A. and then B.Y.P. on Wednesday, Green following him around like a terrier from meeting to meeting and then home, it begins to, like, emerge on Lentz that Bruce G. is starting to treat this walking through the urban PM with Randy Lentz thing as, like, a regular fucking thing. And Lentz starts to jones about it, the unresolved powerless rage issues, that the thing is, now he's gotten so, he's used to resolving them on a more or less nightly basis. So that being unable to be freely alone, to be active with the Browning X-444, or even a steel sack during the 22-16 to 22-26 hour interval, causes this pressure to build up, like almost a withdrawal-grade pressure. But, on the other side of the hand, walking with Green has its positive aspects as well, like that Green doesn't complain about lengthy detours to keep a mainly north-northeastern orientation to the walks, when possible. And Lentz enjoys a sympathetic and listening ear to have around. He has numerous aspects and experiences to mull over, and issues to organize and mull, and, like many people hardwired for organic stimulants, talking is sort of Lentz's way of thinking. But most of the ears of the other residents at Ennett House are not only unsympathetic, but are attached to great, gaping, flapping oral mouths, which keep horning into the conversation with the mouth's own opinions and issues and aspects. Most of the residents are the worst listeners Lentz has ever seen. Bruce Green, on the hand's positive side, hardly says anything. Bruce Green is quiet. The way certain stand-up type guys you want to have there with you, beside you if a beef starts going down, are quiet. Like, self-contained. Yet Green is not so quiet and unresponding that it's like with some silent people, where you start to wonder if he's listening with a sympathizing ear, or if he's really drifting around in his own self-oriented thoughts and not even listening to Lentz, etc., treating Lentz like a radio you can tune in or out. Lentz has a keen antenna for people like this, and their stock is low on his personal exchange. Bruce Green inserts low affirmatives and no shits and fucking A's, etc., at just the right places to communicate his attentions to Lentz, which Lentz admires. So it's not like Lentz just wants to blow Green off and tell him to go peddle his papers and let him the fuck alone after meetings so he can go solo. It would have to be handled in a more diplomatic fashion. Plus, Lentz finds himself nervous at the prospect of offending Green. It's not like he's scared of Green in terms of physically. It's not like he's concerned Green would be the Yule or Day type you have to stressfully worry about, maybe going and ratting out on Lentz's place of whereabouts to the finest, and everything like that. Green has a strong air of non-rat about him, which Lentz admires. So it's not like he's frightened to blow Green off. It's more like very tense and tightly wound. Plus, it agitates Lentz that he has the feeling that it really wouldn't be any big deal to Green that much, one way or the other, and that Lentz feels like he's spending all this stress, tensely worrying about his side of something, that Green would barely think about for more than a couple seconds. And it enrages Lentz that he can know in his head that the tense worry about how to diplomatize Green into leaving him alone is unnecessary and a waste of time and tension, and yet still not able to stop worrying about it, which all only increases the sense of powerlessness that Lentz is impotent to resolve with his browning and meatloaf as long as Green continues to walk home with him. And the schizoid cats with clotted fur that lurk around Ennett House, cringing and neurotic and afraid of their own shadow, are too risky, for the female residents are always formulating attachments to them. And Pat M.'s golden retrievers would be tantamount to legal suicide. On a Saturday, circa 22-21 hours, Lentz found a miniature bird that had fallen out of some nest and was sitting, bald and pencil-necked, on the lawn of Unit Number 3, flapping ineffectually, and went in with Green and ducked Green and went back outside to Number 3's lawn and put the thing in a pocket and went in and put it down the garbage disposal in the kitchen sink of the kitchen, but still felt largely impotent and unresolved. Except for Pat Montesian's bay-windowed front office and the house manager's phone booth-sized back office and the two live-in staff bedrooms down in the basement, none of the doors inside Ennett House have locks, for predictable reasons. Early November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The only bona fide, blackmailable thing about Rodney Tyne, Chief, U.S. Office of Unspecified Services, his special metric ruler. In a locked drawer of his bathroom cabinets at home, on Connecticut Avenue, Northwest in the district, is kept a special metric ruler, and Tyne measures his penis every a.m., like clockwork, has since 12, still does. Plus, a special telescoping traveling model of the ruler he travels with for on-the-road AM penis measurement. President Gentle has no national security agency as such.
228.
Tyne's in Metro Boston because of the national security implications of what they'd first come to unspecified services about two summers past, both the head of DEA and the chair of the Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, now both here standing on one foot and then the other, and twiddling the brims of their hats. This unwatchable underground entertainment cartridge that, at first, seemed to be just popping haphazardly up in random locales. A film with certain, he's given to understand from briefings, quote, qualities, such that whoever saw it wanted nothing else ever in life but to see it again, and then again, and so on. It had popped up in Berkeley, NCA, in the home of a film scholar and his male companion, neither of whom had appeared for appointments for days, and now lost a meaningful human activity henceforward, by all appearances, were the scholar and companion, the two cops dispatched to the Berkeley home, the six cops dispatched after the two cops never followed up their code 5, the Watts sergeant and partner dispatched after them, 17 police, paramedics, and telepeter technicians and all, until the lethality of whatever they'd caught sight of presented itself with enough clarity for somebody to think to go around back and kill the Berkeley home's power. The entertainment had popped up in New Iberia, Louisiana. Tempe, Arizona had lost two-thirds of the attendees of an avant-garde film festival in Arizona State University's Entertainment Studies Amphitheater before a level-headed custodian killed the building's whole grid. Jay Gentle had been apprised about the thing only after it had popped up and taken out a diplomatically immune Near Eastern medical attaché and a dozen incidentals here in Boston, Massachusetts, late last spring. These persons, now, all in wards. Docile and content, but blank, as if, on some deep reptile brain level, pithed. Tyne had toured a ward. The person's lives, meanings, had collapsed to such a narrow focus that no other activity or connection could hold their attention. Possessed of roughly the mental, spiritual energies of a moth now, according to a diagnostician out of CDC. The Berkeley cartridge had vanished from an SFPD evidence room, an electron microscopy toss of which had revealed flannel fibers. The DEA had lost 4 field researchers and a consultant before they'd bowed to the intractable problems involved in trying to have somebody view the confiscated Tempe cartridge and articulate the thing's lethal charms. The strongest possible language had been necessary to restrain a certain famous crooner from attempting a personal review of the thing's qualities. Neither CDC nor the entertainment pros wanted any part of any controlled viewing tests. 3 members of the Academy of DAS had received unlabeled copies in the mail, and the one who'd actually sat down to have a look now needed a receptacle under his chin at all times. Reports of the thing popping up yet again in Metro Boston, Massachusetts, remain unsubstantiated. Tyne's been dispatched here, in part, to coordinate substantiation. There's also the special pocket Franklin planner-sized chart he charts the daily AM penis measurement in, daily, though to the uninitiated, the little leather notebook could look like almost anything statistical at all. But now several USO test subjects, volunteers from the federal and military penal systems, have been lost in attempts to produce a description of the cartridge's contents. The Tempe and New Iberia cartridges are in custody, vaulted. A psychopathic and mentally retarded Lance Corporal at Leavenworth, strapped down with electrode appliques and headset recorder, was able to report that the thing apparently opens with an engaging and high-quality cinematic shot of a veiled woman going through a large building's revolving doors and catching a glimpse of someone else in the revolving doors, somebody the sight of whom makes her veil billow, before the subject's mental and spiritual energies abruptly declined to a point where even near-lethal voltages through the electrodes couldn't divert his attention from the entertainment. Tyne's staff had sifted through dozens of entries before deciding that the intelligence community's terse little name for the allegedly enslaving entertainment would be the Samizdat. PETs on sacrificed subjects revealed unexceptional wave activity, with not near enough alpha to indicate hypnosis or induced dopamine surges. Attempts to trace the matrix of the Samizdat without viewing it, from induction on postal codes, e-microscopies on the brown padded mailers, immolation and chromatography on the unlabeled cartridge cases, extensive and maddening interviews of those civilians exposed, place the likely dissemination point someplace along the U.S. north border, with routing hubs in Metro Boston, New Bedford, and or somewhere in the desert southwest. The U.S.'s Canadian problem is USOUS Anti-ONAN Activities Agency's special province.
229.
So to speak. The possibility of Canadian involvement in the lethally compelling entertainment's dissemination is what has brought to Metro Boston Rodney Tyne, his retinue, and his ruler. Late PM, Monday, the 9th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. For reasons that Pemulus couldn't for the life of him, Ortho Stice seemed to be in there in Dr. Dolores Rusk's office, interfacing with Dr. Rusk well after regular hours. Pemulus paused at the door on his way by.
Nickel assessment, after our work together on your fear of weights, would be that your presenting maladjustment, Ortho, like many males and athletes, is that you're suffering from counterphobia.
Fear of linoleum?
It was unmistakably the flat twang of the darkness in there through the door's wood.
On the level of objects and a projective infantile omnipotence, where you experience magical thinking about your thoughts and the behavior of objects' relations to your narcissistic wishes, the counterphobia presents as the delusion of some special agency or control to compensate for some repressed, wounded inner trauma having to do with absence of control.